Tate Chronicles now transmitting.
Welcome to the Tate Chronicles on Healthcare Now Radio. And now, here's your host, Jim Tate.
Good day, citizens of the free world, from border to border, coast to coast, and to all the ships at sea, I bring you a warm welcome. This is your correspondent, Jim Tate, and thank you for tuning in to the Tate Chronicles. Join me as we cut through the fog that exists at the leading edge of healthcare technology. My guest today is Jim Hammer. Jim is the Vice President of Operations and Product Development at Harmony Healthcare IT. He's been in the healthcare IT industry for 20 years and more, and offers a wealth of knowledge pertaining to both legacy data management and the 21st Century Cures Act compliance. So, Jim, welcome to the show today.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners today.
You know, one of the things that I've seen over the last few decades in healthcare technology, Jim, as if we go from one set of standards to the next, as maybe more specific types of data, that there becomes a real need for what's known as legacy data management, making sure all that other data that's been collected over time in some way can be brought forth and still have value. And I was reading at the Harmony Healthcare IT website, you've kind of outlined a process that talks about the six steps of the data lifecycle. Can you tell us, kind of walk us through those six steps of the data lifecycle?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Jim. You know, first of all, we like to consider ourselves a full service health data management company. And to that end, not only the legacy data management, but really health data management for healthcare institutions in general is who we serve. And just to keep our logical kind of product lines, you know, in sync for us, we've kind of come up with, as you mentioned, the data lifecycle and kind of components to that. And I'll kind of start through that. So, you know, first of all, we do a heavy component of consultation with our clients. As you might imagine, we deal with customers who are individual practitioners through to the largest health IDNs in the country. And a lot of times they're looking for best practice and guidance on what to do with applications and healthcare data. And that's typically how we usually encounter customers are in various life cycle stages of transition or migration from legacy applications into typically one of the, you know, integrated solutions that's in the marketplace today. And that comes about through acquisition, merger, divestiture, and so forth. And really then at that point, they're faced with, you know, what do I do with my data and what, who can help me and what options are available. So that consultation step, really, we do deep discovery to understand, you know, what are the requirements from a government regulation standpoint. So state, local, federal, as well as, you know, agencies and such that kind of dictate retention periods and policies to the individual customers' demands in terms of, you know, what might their strategy be of what they're going to do with the data, whether it be retaining it, migrating it, or ultimately destroying that. And we'll kind of walk through that. So once consultation is done and understood and what the options and systems are that we're looking at, usually we'll move into a phase that we consider extraction. And in our world, we tend to like to be one throat to choke for our customers. So a lot of these systems are very complex. And if we can gain access to them and do the data extraction work ourselves, we like to do that. In some cases, and we'll get into the 21st Century Cures Act a little later, but in some cases we have to go to the source application vendors with our customer partners to obtain the data. We don't like to do that, as I mentioned. Now we've got another, you know, party in the mix that can extend timelines, increase, you know, concern and risk around quality and so forth. But that extraction piece is kind of the first piece is, you know, let's get the data out of the legacy application or source vendor application. And then there's some options to look at. First might be, and again, another category might be migration of that data. So if you think of conversion in the past, you know, customers would go through a pretty lengthy process and detailed process and frankly, very expensive process of converting data from the legacy application to their go-forward production EHR or HIS or revenue cycle system. And what we found there is, you know, the durations of those projects A, took a long time. Usually go live dates would extend past what either the vendor or the customer would like. B, complexity and data mapping involved to, you know, make oranges equal apples in the from the source to the destination location. And then lastly, price. You know, a clinical conversion these days, fully, you know, full clinical conversion or rev cycle can be quite expensive. So, you know, again, we typically find ourselves doing some hybrid of migration. Usually, again, as an example in that, a health system might take 3 years of active patient data for labs and, you know, affectionately PAMI data, problems, allergies, medications, immunizations, and such, and choose to convert that into the production EHR. But then followed right behind that, what we typically do, we'll do a full data migration to our archive platform called Health Data Archiver. And as the years have kind of progressed, we've built a pretty significant playbook to help our customers, again, around best practice. So at a specialty level, at a type of data, whether it be acute or ambulatory or ancillary department, you know, what are the kind of rules of the road and best practices that we find, you know, that across our customer base have been, you know, effectual, quick, and efficient for standing up, like I said, the production solution, as well as keeping and retaining data for regulatory purposes. And again, that Health Data Archiver solution makes sure that providers or end users are very comfortable knowing that they're going to be ultimately able to shut down that source application without worrying if their data is going to be there. Jim, you know, personal experience back in, you know, why we created some of this, you know, the application itself is I ran into an experience where I had a very expensive set of tests done. My provider moved and converted from a legacy application to a production EHR, and they did not do a migration, and they didn't have an archival. And I found myself in, you know, a pretty expensive set of retesting, you know, which certainly didn't make me as a patient happy, and certainly, you know, caused expense that wasn't warranted if they would have had the, you know, the historical data at their fingertips, like you can with an archive. And then lastly, another, you know, item there is we talked a little bit about retention and, the regulatory, you know, most often 7 to 10 years is the typical time span for most healthcare data. That can expand up to perpetual in the case of blood bank and anywhere in between there. And from a kind of a standing down or retaining of the system, you know, and shutting it down and decommissioning it last, you know, destruction, you know, how are you going to shut down that legacy application? And a lot of times we'll be asked, you know, what is the process to help with decommissioning and stepping out of that application and shutting down maintenance contracts, winding down that third party expense that's no longer needed. And ultimately to the point of, you know, what do I need to do with some of my physical hardware to ensure that, you know, it's truly destroyed and there's no PHI kind of living out past that legacy application if there is physical hardware, you know, to that point. And then at the end of that, you know, that data is rich. A lot of times we have a lot more data in the archive solution than, you know, the production system that's been up a year or two. So a lot of times we're performing integration services as well, kind of on the tail end. And that could be to analytics platforms for reporting and research purposes for, you know, academic hospitals and health systems to simply reporting as well as to population health vendors. Really the sky's the limit on, you know, what that data could be, you know, modified to and sent to as an endpoint destination outside of the actual archive for retention purposes. But said a lot there, Jim. I'll hand it back to you.
No, that's, I appreciate you going through all that, Jim. You know, one thing that I'm aware of is how certainly over the last 5 years and increasing, many individual standalone medical practices or labs are being purchased by hospitals. And those hospitals almost invariably, of course, want those practices they are partnering with or acquiring to use their EHR. Mm-hmm. And so it's not always the case where maybe a healthcare provider is switching from by choice from one EHR to another. They're having to do it because who they are becoming affiliated with. And so the issue of, as you said, the timeline, how much data to bring over. You know, this is kind of an ongoing joke. You know, you hear people say, well, how long does healthcare data have to be saved based on regulations? And of course, the answer is it all depends. If it is, you know, if the data is on a patient who's 30 years old, there's one answer. If the patient is 2 years old, it may be a number of years past when they become 18 or 21. It varies quite a bit all over the place. So the idea of bringing what's making decisions as to what is considered best practice usable data, whether you go back 3 or 5 years to bring in to your new system, but it still maintain all the rest and not actually, you know, you archive everything because you never know when you might want to get back to it. And I saw many applications, data migrations or EHR rollouts I was involved with. People were going from paper charts to an EHR. Those paper charts went somewhere and were stored. Now, it would have been nice if they were stored electronically, but, you know, you never want to be in a position of thinking, oh, gosh, I wish I had that data. I wish I could look back and see if it was there or not there or whatever. So,
you know,
the types of healthcare organizations that we talk about that need data migration, you touched on a little bit, but it's certainly not only the providers. It's, I guess, what labs and pharmacies and billing organizations you run across?
Yeah, Jim, I would tell you it's really any healthcare institution. Really, I'll just kind of run through dental, vision, pharma. You know, we talked a little bit about blood bank, certainly behavioral health specialties, you know, from a acute or ambulatory space as well as ancillary departments. It could be not only clinical data as well, but really, you know, if you think about it, health systems and providers' offices, they're a business. So they're often rationalizing general ledger systems, AR payroll systems, material management. Heck, we've got some facilities that have their facilities management and diagramming of their physical plant that they've archived from over the years. So really, again, as you look at those, it's really any data that's healthcare related from any source application that lends itself to this use case.
Let's talk a little bit about the different types of the source data types that might be required to be brought over. It's certainly more than just discrete data, like a diagnostic code. What are the other types of data that might have to be brought to a new system?
Yeah. Good question, Jim. Usually what we find is we kind of aggregate, and as we're doing our consultation and discovery, is we'll look at what we call data domains. So to your point, patient-centric data, typically clinical or revenue cycle-oriented. Data elements from that can be what we talked a little bit, lab, blood bank, pathology, you know, perinatal, surgical, really, you know, anything related to the clinical care of a patient. From the revenue cycle perspective, AR management, so, you know, any of the claims related details, things to support RAC audits or other types of audits that may come up within the revenue cycle environment, you know, again, making sure that you can represent the legal record at time of request for release as needed. As you shift away from the clinical domain, there's usually, you know, facility or administrative related activities and data set from that perspective. So we touched a little on HR payroll data, case management data, risk management data, materials management, and also document management. And document management's unique. It really floats across all the data domains, whether it be clinical, facility related, employee related. So again, HR related, W-2 documents, you name it, from an employee health, you know, employee perspective of needing to retain that data as well. So again, variety of different data domains to look at.
And some of that data is, I guess, lack of a better word, old school data. It can be PDFs. It could be It could be signed consent forms. It could be any of those kind of things. It could be radiographic DICOM images that are really large files. It could be quite a few different things. Now, I know a few. Go ahead, Jim.
I was going to say, Jim, it never ceases to amaze me that every time I think I've seen every data type to be worked, there's a new one that pops up out of the woodwork. So, absolutely.
You know, this idea of data migration or data liquidity, maybe, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago, the Office of National Coordinator in their certification standards for certified health information technology came up with this concept, but they didn't come up with the concept, but the idea of certain file types, whether originally it was a CCR or CCD or now CCDA, and the belief at the time was that these could be created so that you could generate one of these files for every patient in your database, and another certified EHR could import every one of those and make it easier to transition. Now, of course, those files don't carry consent forms or PDFs or DICOMs or any of those kind of things. So it was kind of an attempt, but attempt that I don't know if anybody ever used that functionality. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, good. And you've been along for the ride in that as well. And every time I hear of standards, standards are great, but the flavor of a standard tends to differ at the last mile for almost every vendor. So even with a CCD or CDA, there's just a little tweaking, right, at the final mile that tended to not gain adoption in some cases as much as we would have liked. As we talk about the Cures Act, hopefully there's, you know, a kind of a stick that goes along with that to make that even better, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But you're absolutely right. As we approach some of that consultation that we talked about is education. And some of our customers will say, you know what, if, as long as I, you know, move that CDA document over into my production EHR, I'm good to go. And like you said, Jim, that's maybe, you know, 35 to 55% of the data in a given system. So things like audit history, that's, you know, critically important for, you know, if e-discovery happens. A lot of the textual items that don't get, you know, handled appropriately or well, get left in the lurch if that's not considered. So to your point, what we'll typically find ourselves doing is we'll either ingest CDAs and those types of documents ourselves for some of the core clinical in some cases if we can get that data. We'll also migrate that for a customer from the, you know, source to the new production application, but then again follow that on the back end with a full set of data migration no matter what the data elements are that may not lend themselves to that standard format, exactly to your point.
And I imagine after that takes place, there's some level of QA or quality assurance to make sure that what was in system A is now present in system B, some type of review.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the chain of custody and how that data, you know, morphed and transformed if needed, you know, from the legacy application to the, you know, the either the migrated application or to the archive is vitally important. Absolutely.
Jim, a few minutes ago, you mentioned getting into this discussion about the 21st Century Cures Act. So let's just go ahead and do it. And I know there are a number of different things in the Cure Act that you could talk to us about, and I look forward to hearing your comments. But first, let me just ask you about one of the concepts in there. The Cures Act introduced measures to reduce information blocking. What is information blocking?
Yeah, perfect. I'll give you the example. As we talked about moving data from the legacy application to whatever the end state, whether that be the production EHR, you know, net new production system or to the archive, as I mentioned, we can extract the data from a majority of those systems. But in some cases, and again, some cases, you know, from a vendor perspective, it certainly wasn't a desire in a lot of cases where, you know, those vendors weren't sitting down when they created their application to say, hey, we're going to lose these customers. Let's worry about a, you know, egress path out of our application. So some cases it's just, you know, lack of design up front to be able to get the data out efficiently. To in some cases where really the information blocking I think aimed to is other vendors are truly doing what's called information blocking. And I'll give you the definition from the Cures Act. It's basically defined as blocking as business, technical, and organizational practices that prevent or material discourage the access of the data, exchange, or use when an actor knows or should know that these practices are likely to interfere with access, exchange, or use of EHI. So think of that as a perspective of, you know, I'm asking for my data back and I can't obtain it. And we've run into scenarios where, you know, the vendor tells that customer, literally, your only path forward is to pay us an annual subscription or a, you know, ongoing fee to keep your data accessible with no pathway to obtain their data. So the Cures Act really kind of first shot is to aim to remove that restriction from vendors and, you know, application providers in the market, so that, you know, customers and ultimately patient data isn't held hostage. So definitely that's a large provision of the act, as you mentioned.
To enforce this, does the Cures Act just require an attestation that you're not doing information blocking, and if somebody complains and you are, a pretty hefty fine. How's this going to be regulated?
Yeah. There's definitely, something we should talk about. Actually, yesterday was a pretty important date. In terms of dates of the act, important to note that COVID had a lot of impact on a lot of things. It also impact kind of date targets for the act as well. So yesterday, as a matter of fact, the data blocking, part of the provisions were in place. And as you mentioned, a customer and or patient needs to, report the incident that they've had blocked data. And then there's, provisions in that for, like you said, pretty hefty fines. It's a little gray area right now. I think all vendors, including us, are kind of watching the look at the details and how that plays out. And what we found is a lot of vendors are not, they're already kind of loosening the strings a little bit to make data, to your point earlier, a little bit more liquid. So I think even before, some of this comes into play and gets enacted, again, yesterday is a key date for the data blocking provision. Hopefully that sees those types of things, a little bit less restrictive from those vendors.
And who's this aimed at? Is this a requirement aimed at vendors or providers? Who's?
Both, really. So if you think about it, the end state, which again, if you think of consumerism, the patient's really the focus here. So, ultimately kind of longer state provision is the ability to, transfer data through APIs. And that's really aimed for a patient. So if they want to, let's say, have an Apple application, receive clinical data, historic data on their behalf, that should open up that from, again, from the, the health system or provider perspective. But then that also flows all the way back up to the vendor. So if that EHR provider, as an example, doesn't have the capability to, release the information, again, ultimately API driven, in the later provisions, that's not going to be able to be released through a, the customer. So both provider, health system, as well as the patient really is all encompassed in kind of the act.
Well, you mentioned the standardized APIs, and of course, that's a big step forward. And a lot of EHR vendors I've worked with, when they first hear that they have to open up their data to an unknown third party out there, they say, no, that can't, because it is a revolutionary thing. And so, but the Cure Act really promotes the interoperability of that healthcare data, especially patient access, so that some third party can create an app and with patient permission access that healthcare data that may be in their patient record, whether it's their provider or hospital or whatever. What's the deadline for is there a deadline for these standardized APIs so third parties can access that data?
Yeah, John, I'll kind of walk back through the critical dates again. Great. So yesterday, electronic health information that's limited to, and you've heard this before, I've heard on some of your other interviews, the US CDI specifications. So the limited data set that's clinical in nature, that was effective yesterday to reduce and eliminate blocking. The next critical date kind of in line is October 6th of 2022. At that point, no EHI or electronic health information is limited and off limits from that that restriction of no longer blocking the data. And then kind of the next key to your point about the API comes in December 31st of 2022. So at that point, standardized API functionality needs to be in place for the things that we talked about. And frankly, that's exciting because, again, at that point, talk about data liquidity. At that point, if you think of the consumer and the patient, that data is really theirs. And at that point, it should be free flowing to whoever needs it when needed at the point that it's needed. So pretty exciting. It's definitely a lift for vendor and the application, community to rise to that bar. But, definitely, I think something that's beneficial for the patient ultimately.
That's right. And I know those deadlines have been moved around or delays have been put in for a number of these different programs because of COVID, but I don't think they're going to be moved anymore. So it is exciting. Jim, before we totally run out of time, how can our listeners learn more about Harmony Healthcare IT or get in touch with somebody?
Yeah, absolutely. your user listeners can definitely reach out to harmonyhit.com. It's our website. And certainly reach out to contact to schedule for any time to talk. Or again, on our website is a blog and a lot of content for folks who are kind of diving into healthcare data journey and might need be in need of, you know, health data management services as well. And definitely can look us up on social media as well.
You know, I'll second the motion on your blogs at the website. I read quite a few of them yesterday, and there's a lot of good meat in those blogs.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good resource, Jim. To our audience, hard to believe we're out of time, but thanks for joining me on this episode of the Take Chronicles. I offer a special salute to my guest today, Jim Hammer of Harmony Healthcare IT. Jim, thanks for coming aboard today.
You bet, Jim. Thanks for the ride.
You can find more information on this show's program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And until we meet again, here's wishing you smooth sailing and safe harbors.
Tate Chronicles transmission ending now.